If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this special edition of the Late Night Podcast. A few weeks ago, Jeff Tweedy of Wilco performed 2 nights on Late Night. While he was here, the HE Band's keyboardist Eli Janney sat down with Jeff and they chatted about their music careers. Here's their conversation.
Hello, everybody. This is Eli Janney. I'm the keyboard player and sometimes band leader of the HE Band, and I'm sitting here with Jeff Tweedy. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for doing this. We just want to talk to you a little bit since we have you captive. I wanted to ask you a bunch of questions. So I think that we played together. Mm-hmm. Like, it had to have been 91 or 92, but
if it's that long ago, there's very, very little chance I would recollect.
There's a lot. That's good. That's good. I'm glad you don't remember, because my memory of that was me not being very nice. Like, I think at that period I was like, I'm the cool rock star kid.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We probably were antisocial, but we wouldn't have been mean.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have been mean, I would have been antisocial.
Yeah.
Just because, I don't know, insecurity, suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It is funny how when you going from being a very young adult, let's put it that way, to like then
a very old adult.
Yeah. To a middle-aged person like we are now. It is funny to continuously play music throughout that whole thing, and your perspective on what is important, what is not important, seems to change a lot. I mean, I feel like that your career, starting with Uncle Tupelo and then progressing through all these, I feel like there's just the amount of time that Wilco's been together, and then you're doing all these other projects, your perspective must have changed on what's important as far as what's important to you and what's important for music.
A yes and no. I think that at some point, something must have clicked that allowed me to make choices that ended up in it being this sort of sustained thing that has a pretty decent balance of realistic expectations and an appreciation for getting to do it for a long time, or I don't know. I'm still sort of, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I think first of all, nobody ever threw tons and tons of money at us and said, you guys are going to be stars.
Yeah.
That I thank God for that all the time. That would have ruined everything. But anybody that did appeal to my ambition in that way, I sensed, and I had enough sense to realize that they were scum at an early age, and like didn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, my idea of being able to make music and live is still firmly rooted in the monkeys. You know, it's really rooted in this sort of utopian, silly daydream of getting to be a part of like a group of guys that are fun and it's a good thing to do. You know, what's wrong with that? But I also think it's a Midwestern work ethic that just feels like, well, you're supposed to go to work every day.
Yeah. You know? Well, you've not been lazy, that's for sure. I mean, it's interesting because you now, like last night you played kind of one of the hits of Wilco, right? Wouldn't you say?
Oh, well, yeah. It's a well-known song.
Well-known song.
I don't know if it hit anything.
I know, but you know what I mean. It's like, yeah. You know, even in Girls Against Boys, like we had the songs that we considered like the hits. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The popular song.
Right.
Not never a hit, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, we play it a lot.
Some of those songs you played hundreds of times. Does the passion for playing those songs like wax and wane? Or
I tell people this all the time. I don't care about any of them.
Really?
I don't really feel like I have a deep connection with anything other than what I'm working on at the moment. You know, yeah. Like what I'm really excited about making now, which has sustained me for a long time.
Yeah.
That's the part of it that is really sustaining to me. Once it's done, and especially once it's out there, it's very little use to me anymore.
Oh.
But that frees me up to be really excited when other people are excited.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
If I go play a song, I do a lot of living room shows and things like that for charity. And those are really great examples of that because they always request all the songs. It's like 30 people and I do 30 songs and they're all requested. And they're always songs that I've forgotten, songs I don't want to play, songs that they're just asking me to play because they know I don't know how to play it anymore or whatever. And I like try and learn all these songs and do them and they always feel really meaningful to me in that when that connection's being made, when that circuit's kind of being closed with someone else's kind of like, I don't know, consciousness on the other end.
Yeah.
And you can feel it.
Where their view of it is like, they have an excited view of it. They think it's a great song. Yeah.
I know. So exactly it's just like, I've had friends and people that have had really, really big hit songs and they don't want to play them and they hate them. And I'm like, get over it.
Yeah.
I don't always feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say what it's like to have that. So I don't know.
Right.
I can understand
finding
it, feeling necessary to distance yourself from something that is so narrowly defining who you are.
If
you have like one song that everybody knows. Luckily, Wilco really doesn't have one song.
That's true.
That we have to play.
No, you don't think Heavy Metal Drummer?
No. No. We've done tons of shows without playing Jesus, etc.
Yeah,
stuff like that. But we do most of the time. But you know, but
no, I saw.
People don't throw things.
Yeah, they don't get mad.
They don't get that visibly.
Yeah,
there also is a really polite audience. There,
yeah,
so they're like, you know,
it's interesting.
They blog about it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you were talking about being in the moment of what you're creating, because just going from being in a band to doing this show where we are required to like write music every day, the stuff that we play on the show, we've written that day. So we're on the clock, being creative on the clock.
Mm-hmm.
How do you continue to find that creativity? I know you're not on the clock the same way we are. We're literally on a clock.
Yeah.
But you feel like what you're working on in the moment, do you ever worry about not being able to...
No, I mean,
it's been pretty constant.
That sounds like a fun challenge to be able, you know, to be asked to come up with something every day. But I'm sure that you don't come in really that worried about it. I'm sure that you feel like
now
it's like
don't.
A faucet, you know, like that something is going to happen. And for me, I go to the studio every day when I'm home and I feel like that excitement, like something's going to happen that, you know, I'll probably go home today and there'll be something there that wasn't there when I got there.
Yeah.
And that's a really good feeling, even if it's a steaming pile of dung. it's least it's out of you, you know, but also, you know, like a bad song or if you're frustrated with a part on a song or something like that, none of that is very high stakes.
Yeah,
you know,
when you
look at the way the world is.
That's true.
You get to do that.
Yeah, we have a joke with Seth Meyers because when we started the show, his wife was a DA, assistant DA in Brooklyn, and she worked in like terrible crimes mm-hmm. or something. And my wife is a physician assistant. She works in neurosurgery. So our bad days are like, I missed that cue or that joke didn't hit. And then their bad days are like somebody died. You know, like it's just not on the same
Nobody's
level.
Nobody's going to die when you have a bad song.
When you have a bad show.
If a bad performance was going to end my career, it would have happened a long time ago, I would assume. I don't know.
Yeah. When I went out on the road with you guys for that Ashes American Flags thing that Brendan and, and Christoph made, it was so much fun. We went down there through the South and played those shows. But I was kind of amazed at the appeal of Wilco. Not, you know, I know I knew you guys were very popular, but we were in, I think it was Mobile, Alabama, playing this huge auditorium. And at the same time, you could be playing, you know, up in Seattle and probably, you know, like, why do you think that there's this appeal for Wilco where people would not equate those two areas as having similar tastes?
I think it's, I have no idea what the appeal is. I honestly don't. Only thing I can say that might have something to do with that, that maybe another band wouldn't have that same experience, is that we've beat our head against the wall going back to these places for, for 20-something years. And then before that with Uncle Tupelo. So 30 years almost of
touring and touring and touring.
And really early on, we decided that we didn't want to be a band that had to go play our strong city to survive. Because early on, there were a few cities like, oh, we have to go play Minneapolis because it's gonna, we need money, you know. And that was a terrible feeling because, you know, the third time you play there in a year, there's less people, you know. Like, you get to, you kind of are taken for granted and people assume you're coming through. And so we early on, we decided that we were always going to make a sizable portion of our touring be places we'd never played before.
Oh, interesting.
And on every tour, try and go somewhere where we haven't gone and do whole tours of places we haven't been before.
Tertiary markets.
And I'm like, tell them, this is a great night. We're really warming up for our show in New York tonight. So thanks for coming out. No, like, I don't know. Just like, it just felt better to us to like, broaden a little bit. And then after a while we were able to go like 5 years without playing in Manhattan, you know, like we were able to sort of sustain ourselves without overplaying any of our big places, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. We did a tertiary tour and I was always struck by how appreciative the people were. Like, you play Lubbock, Texas, and they're so psyched.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up across the river from St. Louis, Missouri, which is, you know, probably on that type of plane in terms of, you know, I wouldn't say it's probably not a tertiary market, but it's close, you know. And so I remember that was the way we felt, you know. And
people were psyched.
Jody Foster's Army came to town. Why would they come here? I don't know.
Awesome. Okay, I need to ask you about this. I know you have a history with President Obama. You knew him just when he was a senator. You were playing.
Yeah, we did campaign events and some fundraisers earlier on in his political career. And as he was kind of ascending in the in the national spotlight. He introduced us at Farm Aid in Chicago, and he was starting to be, I don't know, really looked at as a serious contender for the White House and stuff like that. So, yeah, we signed a poster to him one time, like in like 2005 or something. I don't know, it was a long time ago. Like, signed a poster, see you at the inauguration or something, like joking.
Really?
And he said, if Hillary invites us.
Right.
That's what he said.
I see. And then did you end up playing the inauguration?
No, we did not.
That's amazing, though.
Somebody named Beyonce or something like that.
I wanted to ask you about this. You appeared last season 7 of Portlandia. You did a sketch about making music and being authentic. You've been on Portlandia a couple times, right? But there was one that I loved where Fred and Carrie played record producers. They were just, I just want to play a clip so that we can, I want to get your comment on it. So let's take a listen.
You got a broken soul and a dusty heart.
Jeff, sorry. I'm sorry to stop you. I'm just, what's up with these lyrics then? That dusty road?
What was that first line again?
Got a broken soul.
Just say it. Say it to me.
I've got a broken soul and a dusty heart.
Are your family Okies? Did they experience the Dust Bowl? Or?
No, they're like upper management. It's not literal dust.
But Jeff, here's the thing about folk music. Take someone like Woody Guthrie. What a hard life he had. His sister died in a coal oil fire. His mom went crazy. His dad was burned as well in a coal oil fire. And then he ended up drowning later on. And if your heart is not literally brimming with dust, let's sing about something else.
Right. Press record.
Got a dusty heart and a broken road.
Hey, Jeff.
Yep. Were you in a coal oil fire?
Coal oil?
Coal oil? Coal oil fire?
No.
We just want to know, what have you lived and where did you grow up?
I grew up in the suburbs.
Were there any coal oil fires there?
Bonfires when our football team won.
Now, I've asked you this a lot, and I know you think I'm going to say coal oil, but do you know someone who was in a coal oil fire?
Canola oil, maybe?
No.
Press record.
Like a crooked train, I'll tear the world apart.
Forget about the crooked train, unless you've been on a crooked train. It would be problematic.
The smoke alarm ran out of batteries one time.
It was really funny,
but... It really hit home. I really felt... First of all, I didn't grow up in the suburbs. But people really believe all of that stuff.
Middle management.
My dad, the weird thing is, my dad worked on the railroad for 46 years. So I could exploit some right, folk music bona fides.
Right, authenticity.
No, but I was really excited to be asked to do that because it's one of my pet peeves about a lot of different genres of music
right.
needing tropes to.
Right.
To signal authenticity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was what I was wondering about. It's like that it's sort of skewering that the just crazy in all types of music.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever metal, it is.
If you're, like, you can't, you know, write a subtle,
yeah,
subtle lyric about, you know, childbirth or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like all these, even like, especially in punk music, when we grew up and growing up in DC, mm-hmm. like the authenticity was such a big deal. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I don't know. I just thought it was funny.
You had to be living at a shelter or
yeah,
something.
Exactly. Meanwhile, of course, we did all live in the suburbs. Like, yeah, you know, like.
Right.
But anyway.
Well, that, Belleville's sort of, I guess it's sort of a suburb, but it's like. Not like what people picture as a suburb.
Right, yeah. Like a leafy kind of rich
more like a factory town suburb. But yeah, that's a rough thing to transcend for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's kind of funny though. At the same time, I think when in that sort of mid-90s when we signed to Geffen, it was such a big deal, like coming mm-hmm. from Touch and Go, mm-hmm. even though we like finished our agreement with Touch and Go, but moving to Geffen was such a like taboo and there was such a big deal. And now I feel like it's not, there's no such thing.
Right.
Yeah, like kids are just like, what do I have to do to survive being a musician?
I always use my dad as a good barometer. Mm-hmm. If I had to explain to my dad, this company offered us like $400,000 to play a couple of songs in a commercial.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about that, Dad? And it was like, we'll take the money.
Yeah.
And if I said, well, I'm thinking about not doing it, what would my dad's reaction would be?
Are like, you crazy?
Why? Like, so what? So you can be poor? So you can not have money?
Be authentically poor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a privileged position to be in, to be able to think about selling out.
Yeah.
That's true. To even think about it. To even entertain the notion of a concept of selling out is so privileged.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Yeah, I remember Henry did a thing about somebody was complaining because there was, I can't remember if it was MC5 or Iggy Pop song that had been put into a commercial, and people are up in arms, and he was just like, what, fuck you. Like, pay them. This is a band that needs, like, they need money. Mm-hmm. Pay them as much as possible. You know, right. Like, well, why? This is a great band. Mm-hmm. You know, like, why should they not get paid?
Exactly. You know? Well, Wilco had some songs in a VW commercial, or a series of VW commercials a few years ago, pretty long ago now. And that was like one of those little tempest in a teapot things, you know, people got upset about it. And we're kind of friends with Lydia Lunch, or you know, Nels is friends with her. And we saw her when she was in Barcelona, and she's like, take their fucking money.
Yeah.
Always take their fucking money. Why did they have, why should they have it?
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't know. I just thought it was funny how the tenor of the times has changed so much, where now kids are, if someone has a band, I think it's, I feel like it's a lot harder to survive as a band, a young band.
Well, it's had to change. People have had to, like, be more open to different ways of making a living as a musician, because nobody's going to pay for music, then, you know, the van isn't going to put gas in itself.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
That's true. But at the same time, I'm amazed.
Now it's a sign of authenticity to have a commercial.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, but I'm amazed that even though it does seem a lot harder to survive, you know, we would, you know, I think similar to you guys, is just like you create a record and then you go on tour, and then you come back. And you have some money from the sales of that record to live off of while you create the next one. So you can live and write. But I don't know, without those record sales, like, how do the kids, like, survive that year?
Right. Well, I mean, we never...
I don't mean, like, huge sales, but I mean, you know.
We've never really had enough from record sales, honestly, to... It's always been, we never really tour on album cycles. We're always kind of touring a certain amount every year to do what we need to do. Like, even if we were started recording the next record, we'd go out in the middle of it for a couple of weeks to pay for the rent.
Nice. And stuff,
you know, okay. We just kind of broke our connection to the album cycle a long time ago.
That's
and it
great.
Really helped a lot.
Yeah, it sure did.
It's like, is our defining characteristic as a band a piece of plastic that we're, you know, presenting to the world every 2 years or 3 years? Or is it because we get together and create and make music? And I don't know, it felt better when we focused on that.
That's great.
But anyway, I don't know. It's different. I think that in some ways it's actually, I understand it's really hard to make a living, but I also feel like there are a lot of opportunities for young people making music that weren't available.
Yeah.
It was like, really, when we started, it was crazy to think about even making a record.
Yeah.
The thought of, like,
how
do you do that? Where do you go? None of us knew anything about how, maybe at the, you know, towards the beginning, they started having cassette home recording and stuff like that. But now anybody can make a great sounding record in their closet.
It's crazy.
And immediately put it out into the world on Bandcamp.
And
roll the dice, and maybe somebody's going to find something and be interested in it. And I still think you have to get out there and play to probably make it work.
That's true.
And I don't think that's
touring is just as important as it ever was. All right. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jeff Tweedy from Wilco.
Thanks so much. Music all day long.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.